I think that many of you noticed that we had guests for lunch. And one of the guests was a woman named Blanche Hartman, who is probably the most senior Buddhist teacher in the Bay Area at 87 years old. Beautiful woman, been a teacher for a long time, a Zen practitioner for a long time. Was the abbess of the San Francisco Zen Center for a while. And she said over lunch that not so long ago, she went to visit a student of hers who was dying, in bed dying. And it turned out the student only had 6 days left to live. And Blanche went to see her. And sat next to her in the chair, and Blanche, in her direct way, said to her student something like, "Well, I guess pretty soon you're going to know about the great mystery." Whereupon her student, she jumped out of bed and threw out her arms and gave Blanche a big hug and said, "It's all about love and joy." So that made a big impression on Blanche. She told us the story, and I'm telling you. It's all about love, joy. Someone's last words, or close to the last words. And not a few people have come to that conclusion sooner or later. Sometimes come to that conclusion when, especially the love part, when there's nothing else to do. Nothing else left to do. Or what else can you do but to love? And I consider Buddhist practice, this kind of practice, as an act of love, because it can be a way of caring for ourselves, caring for our world around us. And can come out of a certain kind of love, self-care, to do this. Though, it's not always obvious that's the case when there's all this mostly just war going on inside. But I think even so, it's an attempt to try to better oneself, have a better life, to improve one's condition of our world. And I think of that coming from a care. And I think there's a basic caring that we all have. And maybe what it looks like as a kind of love might not be the hallmark version, but I think it's a kind of caring. And so when we have these four clear ways of understanding, four clear comprehensions, they begin with intention, with purpose. And so in terms of practice, that intention can be informed by our care, by our love, love for ourselves, love for others, love for the world. Or if you don't care for that four-letter word, our compassion. And what is one of the primary expressions of compassion is to want to certainly appreciate what we care for, to have appreciation, respect, valuing, and to want what we care for to be well, to thrive, to live beneficially, to be happy. And so underneath, the kind of the path of Buddhism is this drive, this motivation for benefit, for improving our lives, at least our happiness, to decrease the suffering we have. As it's been said now in the West often enough, suffering is optional. And so if it's optional, let's figure out how it's optional. It's easier said than done, but it's kind of the good news is that it's optional. So what does it take? What are the practices? What's the approach of life that helps us find our way? And so the clear comprehension begins with this clarity around the purpose and intention that we're here for. And generally in Buddhism, the encouragement is to have that sense of purpose be practical and have a sense of how it's practical as opposed to metaphysical, as opposed to abstract spiritual ideas. And so perhaps something like becoming one with the cosmos is somewhat abstract. And but to no longer be afraid, I think it's a little more practical, down to earth. And so there's a variety of kind of great abstractions, and Buddhism itself offers all kinds of wonderful abstractions that sometimes most people don't have a clue what they're about, but they know they want them. You know, like getting enlightened is one of them. Some people have the Big Bang theory of enlightenment. Not even knowing, you know, if once it explodes, whether you're going to be around to what's going to be left. There was monumental news this week. The universe is never the same. Turns out we're 80 million years older than we thought. They kind of recalibrated new research when the Big Bang was, and it was 80 million years earlier. So you thought you were, you know, you thought you were more mature than your age, but maybe you're not quite. You still have some growing to do. And then they discovered apparently that, it was one of those basic tenets of physics that I grew up with, that nothing is faster than the speed of light. But at least the reports here is now that in the first period, I don't know how long that was, after the Big Bang, the whatever it was there expanded faster than the speed of light. So you have to look quickly. And then 380 million years after the Big Bang is when light and matter separated. What was that before? What was it that could separate? So here we come. We have this building and a ceiling and a floor and lights that are on and, you know, what in the world is this mystery we're in? And if 380 million years when light and matter separated, what's going to happen? Is it 15 point, now it's 8 billion years, or however long it is? Who knows? We might separate or combine. Or maybe we'll love. Maybe that's what's coming forth, is our capacity to have an open heart, a clean heart, a peaceful heart. And so this wonderful world of ours, and where we suffer, people suffer, and we have this practice. It's possible to practice. And the Buddha said it's possible to do something about it. And it's possible to somehow benefit ourselves in what Buddhism considers the highest benefit, which is to become free of the heart suffering. The heart doesn't have to suffer. And to be resolved on that is one of the clear senses of purpose. But even that might be kind of abstract, because it's kind of lofty, you know, end of suffering. And so the clear comprehension of purpose, of intention, can be, you know, small steps along the way. What's the step today to do that? Maybe to be a little more kinder to myself, or more accepting, maybe to be firmer with myself, maybe to be more honest. There's many kind of steps along the way. But we set a course, we set a sense of purpose that has words like commitment, resolve, decisiveness, aspiration. So all these great words. I love the word commitment because of how it comes from the Latin word to touch with. You know, like word mitten, it means like, so like commitment means to touch. So to touch something. Something practical, tangible. Our commitment or our sense of purpose or our intention is kind of like the ballast for our lives. With a strong sense of purpose, then whatever goes on in our life, we're not pushed over so easily when we know what our purpose is. And that's a very different thing to discover than to discover who you are. The whole question of who you are is a little bit complicated, but it might not be so complicated to have a sense of purpose, to establish a sense of purpose, even if it's a very, very modest one. This is the purpose for now. And in my Zen training, they talked a lot about emptiness and how everything is empty and there's no ground to stand on. But so what do? You rely, in Zen they said you rely on your vow. There's a vow. And the vow in Zen is usually worded in the, what's called the four bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless, I vow. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them all. Delusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them all. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to go through them all. And Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to attain it. And so that becomes the ballast, it becomes the direction, it becomes, this, you know, for a Zen student, you know, this is what my life is about. And so then decisions can be made based on that sense of purpose. Or any, you know, once you have a purpose, once you have a purpose, you have an orientation, you have a way to choose. The second step of the eight of the clear comprehensions, what is suitable, what is appropriate? Given this purpose, what is useful, what is helpful? If there's no purpose and you don't know what you're here for, then you can't answer that question. So it gives a kind of a direction. And so it's been said that the clear comprehension of purpose belongs to that side of Buddhist practice which has to do about cultivating strength, cultivating our, developing ourselves. It's the strong, it's the foundation, it's a firm foundation for us. It's also been said that the clear comprehension of appropriateness or suitability is what helps us to be soft, to find out what's suitable so we don't get tight or rigid around it, because tightness and rigidity goes against the purpose of becoming peaceful or relaxed or happy. One of the, I think, very, very meaningful things about the earliest Buddhist teachings is that the goal of practice is to be contained in the means, that the goals and the means are not supposed to be so separate. So what this means is that, so for example, if a goal is to be generous, the means to be generous is start being generous. You don't like we wait around and, or engineer generosity. You know, you cultivate. Or if you want to be calm, you start being calm, a little bit. Or if you want to be honest, you start being honest. If you want to be peaceful, you start being peaceful. If you want to be awake, you start being mindful. So there's a way in which the means and the goals are in harmony, work together, or the goal is reflected in the means. So if you find yourself practicing in such a way that you feel like you're getting super tight or closed in or claustrophobic, then you can ask, you know, is the goal reflected in the means? And I know that me and many people have practiced Buddhism with striving and pushing And with sometimes with even with animosity, I hate my hate. I'm going to pulverize the smithereens. And then you know, I used to have a lot of aversion towards my physical pain. And so, you know, I had a great way of overcoming physical pain. I'll just get concentrated. And pretty much anyone who develops some capacity of concentration, I believe sooner or later will use the concentration to avoid. So that works. That was a great technique. So I just knew, I just sit down, get focused, and no pain. It was great. It was great as long as it worked. And then it stopped working. And then what? And then it started working, then stopped working, then I would huff and puff more because it had worked. So I was kind of like caught, and I thought I had this thing to do. So eventually I was very lucky that it stopped working, because then I had to be honest. I had to face what was there. I had to stop putting on blinders. So if you want to be awake, you can't be asleep. If you want to be awake, the process of being awake is to wake up to what's going on. And not in some strange, I don't know, strange, but some ultimate kind of metaphysical or cosmic or spiritual way to wake up. But it's a very ordinary expression to wake up, to be awake to what's happening. The goal is to be awake, and the means there is start being awake. So the sense of purpose then is matched, is partnered with suitability, appropriateness, to help us know how to hold that purpose, how to be wise about it, how to make it useful. How to know when it's the right purpose in a particular time, what's the appropriate practices and tools and ways of being with it. But without the purpose, there's not the orientation, there's not the we don't have the information to make decisions by, because, so the purpose. And the sense of purpose, or intention, or aspiration, can vary a lot over time. As I said, sometimes it can be, you know, small ones for this day, for this sitting, for this conversation I'm going to have with someone. This is my intention. This is for my work. And sometimes it can be something global that's for our life. This is what I want my life to be about. And so we set the course in that direction. So this idea that it could shift and changes over time. And I think it's important to get a sense of a little bit how it changes and how it can be expressed and experienced at different times. So I thought I might share with you a little bit some of my journey of through this world of intention, of purpose. I began my Buddhist practice because I was suffering. And I thought that socially and personally, in a variety of ways in which I was struggling in my life, that somehow Buddhist practice was going to help. So that's when I really got started with it and took it seriously, was to try to deal with that. As I practiced some time, that reason, not that I stopped suffering, but that reason, that motivation, somehow organically fell away. And I continued to meditate twice a day. Well, I was in college, so I was kind of busy, but I meditated every day, invariably. I was committed to that, except on Sunday. Took a day off. And after a while, I couldn't see the purpose or the reason why I was meditating, practicing. And I was some kind of a rational guy. I was kind of like, why is this? I kept thinking about it for quite a while, some months. I kept sitting, why am I doing this? I'm supposed to have a reason to do something like this. And eventually what came out for me was that I was sitting as a form of self-expression. As an artist expresses herself through art, or a dancer through dance, so for me, this was my form of self-expression. Something was just there. And that was enough reason for me. That was, I mean, not just enough. That was a very meaningful and purposeful thing for me to do. And then at some point, I continued practicing, and I started to appreciate that in that expression of sitting, there was a feeling of integrity that I had. And it dawned on me at some point, why should I only feel integrity while I'm meditating? I mean, it's the same mind I take around with me and I have in meditation. Maybe I could try finding some way to live this integrity, express this or feel this way in my life. And so that became my purpose, was how can I live this more in my daily life? So it began as meditation, and what happened in meditation became something I wanted to bring with me in my life. Not in terms of calm, not so much in terms of mindfulness. I was a Zen student, and back then we didn't talk about mindfulness so much. But it was a sense of integrity that was important. So that became the purpose, you know, finding that way. And then, as I continued to practice, there were times where the purpose was, again, not so clear that there was an inner purpose, you know, a clear purpose of why I was doing it, but it became not so much to express myself, maybe related to that, but to make room to allow something to bubble up through me. Something felt like it wanted to come out. And so I felt like, what is it that wants to come? So I got kind of, let's get out of the way. Let's get out of the way. And then at some point, something started to happen. I felt like, conventionally you can say the path of practice, the path of freedom started to unfold for me or something. And then it felt more like the purpose of my practice, what I was, in terms of what I was doing, was even more, was to get out of the way. And mostly I felt like, you know, I was like a, if a ball is rolling down a hill and you stop it, you have to hold it there to keep it from rolling. If you move your hand away, it rolls down. And I felt that there was a momentum in my heart, momentum inside towards practice, towards freedom, towards something, that it wasn't exactly personal. It wasn't like something like, I could say, me, but it was more like, this wants to come through, this wants to happen, and it's work. It's a work to stop it. And so it was just like, just get out of the way, let it happen, let it move through, let it unfold. So I wanted space and time to let that come through. And then there were times where I touched something that deep inside, which I'd never touched before, and it became important to touch it again. It was like something that, you know, I saw something, touched something, and it became almost imperative. I had no choice but to somehow go into meditation and touch that place again. And so that's what motivated me to go back on my longest retreat, was to somehow, I had to touch that place. And oddly enough for a Buddhist, I felt like a little kernel of self. I knew, that somehow you're not supposed to have this idea of a kernel of self, but that's what it felt like, a little kernel of self down there. And I had to touch that place again. I didn't feel like it was bad, but, you know, it was, you know, I had no choice. And it became kind of a dark night of the soul for me, period, because it was so important to, you know, nothing else mattered. And nothing else mattered. And I just had to, you know, that seemed like the most important thing. It wasn't like a decision exactly. It wasn't a, you know, there was, I don't know how much wisdom there was, but I just knew that nothing else mattered. This is what I had to do. Touch this place. So I sat my longest retreat, and instead of touching it, it all dissolved. The need dissolved. The place dissolved. The thing I touched dissolved. You know, just so it kind of resolved by dissolving somehow. And then there are times when it was very important for me, that especially when I remember very clear at the Zen Center, where they kind of had a practice there of, I think I mentioned, of radical acceptance. Just to be fully present for things as they were, and not to be dualistic, not to see anything as right or bad, good or bad, and to just be present, and not to have any techniques, not to try to attain anything. There was not, weren't supposed to have a goal. And I was a gardener at that time, and I walked around in the morning before I started actually doing the work in the garden, and I would walk around and look at the garden, kind of very kind of paternal, looking at the garden, tending the plants. And I would see these weeds growing, and you know, the weeds were crowding out the vegetables and stuff. And when I got to work, I'd pull out the weeds. And I thought, well, this is my job. I'm supposed to be doing this, is you know, to pull out the weeds in the garden. So somebody said, what about the weeds in my mind? Am I supposed to just leave them in there? Isn't that it's natural enough to pull the weeds from the garden? Isn't it natural enough to pull the weeds from my mind? Why shouldn't I not do that? Why should I? You know, I had this idea in Zen, you're not supposed to do anything. And so I thought, what about my anger? I mean, am I supposed to just kind of like, just be better at anger? By accepting it? And so then I got interested. It felt like a completely, I didn't see anything wrong, defiled about, or mistake, you know, about trying to overcome the anger. And I approached it not as something I had to do or be successful at, but it's just a natural thing to do, to kind of work on this and look at it and be present and try to. And then around the same time, this sense of purpose that became central to my adult life was the idea that I'm doing this not just for myself, but doing this for other people as well. That somehow what I wanted my life purpose to be was to support other people. Mostly what I thought I would do was help other people practice Buddhism, because it was the only thing I knew in my limited world that could address the deepest suffering that human beings have. And I wanted a life that was addressing the deepest roots of suffering in human beings. I didn't feel like I could live a life that somehow was skirting around, or not somehow, at least attempting to address it. I didn't know how successful I'd be, but this is what I wanted to do. And it didn't really matter that much if I was successful. I was just happy to have a path. This was my sense of purpose. And this has been one of my joys of being a Buddhist practitioner, is the joy of having a path of practice that's meaningful and a purpose that's meaningful. And it's almost as if it's more joyful or more meaningful to have the path to walk on than to have any idea of how successful I'll be in walking it. So I think sometimes conventionally people think it's the goal which is important, the success that's important. It certainly has its role, you know, but it was felt like it was enough just to have a path. In this lifetime, I found a really good path, and I can walk it. I could do the different parts of the steps of the practice. So at some point, the sense of purpose came together with this idea of doing it for others. But as I became to do it for others, one of the interesting things that happened to me, I was ordained as a Zen priest, Zen monk, and you know, they shave your head and give you robes to wear. So you become kind of a public figure. And so people kind of, you know, see you as a kind of like religious person, right? And so what happened then was that I became much more self-aware of my shortcomings. But what was great was that because I was ordained, I'm kind of like not so interested in religion. I mean, oddly enough, right? maybe you don't believe me, but given my profession, so it wasn't so interested in these like Zen rituals and stuff. But they did this this whole ceremony to ordain me. It's the most elaborate ceremony I've ever done in my life. And I just kind of thought, I'll just go through it, the steps, forms, you put your foot, you step here, you say this, and it's over, and, you know, you're a monk. And, but I was surprised at what a big impact the ceremony had. The ritual really affected me. And the biggest way it affected me was that I became more aware of my shortcomings, and it was more okay to have them, because now I was a child of the Buddha. kind of thing. So that was kind of a nice combination, I thought. It was lovely to become more aware of your shortcomings, because then you can take responsibility for them, start practicing, have a direction to go, try to improve in some way. But at the same time, it was more okay to have them. You know, it's okay to be to be flawed. I was more relaxed about it. And that combination of being relaxed, okay, and then also try to work with them, I thought was a lovely combination. So then also then, you know, this idea of practicing and practice working on myself, then became part of the purpose of that, part of what fueled that, was the fact that, you know, I wanted to be supportive of other people. I wanted to be a person who could be helpful to others. And so, you know, I better kind of work on some of these things that were going on in there. And then sometimes a sense of purpose, and the last one I'll share now, is oddly enough, after all this discussion of purpose, was the purpose was to have no purpose, because of knowing what a tremendous relief and freedom there can come when the mind is not involved in the activity of intentions, wanting, purpose, anything at all. And so it was, again, more like getting out of the way. And almost more of the practice became a not doing practice, not doing, to just allow this clarity or this freedom of not wanting to kind of emerge and be there. So as you go through your life and through your practice time, perhaps you also will find that your sense of purpose will change and vary over time, depending on the circumstances of your life, circumstances of your psychology and what needs to be met. But certainly my hope is that you remember that perhaps you can tap into your love, your care, that it's an act of generosity and care and respect for yourself that you do this. I think there was a note on the board downstairs about desire and also about this not-self thing, this no-self thing. And you're not supposed to have any desires now that you're a Buddhist. Or you're not supposed to have a self. When you come to IRC, check yourself at the door. Hand it in. If you need it, we'll give it back. You know, together with your cell phone. How about that if the registration said that? If you use the sign the agreement saying, for this retreat, you agree not to use the self. Not to use the self in the course of the retreat. And if you have a problem with that, hand it in. And if you need it at the end, if you want it at the end, we'll give it back. So this whole thing can be confusing for people. And so I wanted to read something I came across recently. There's a Buddhist scholar and a Buddhist teacher named Joy Manet. And she wrote some great pieces on early Buddhism. And in this article, she wrote this. At a recent conference whose theme was the psychology of awakening, Buddhism, science, and psychotherapy, many of the participants expressed their confusion regarding how the Buddha could function in the world without a self. Because they were Buddhists, they were trying to follow the teaching and to achieve or to imitate what they imagined this form of functioning could be, meaning being and no self. I thought they had missed the point. When the texts, the suttas, the ancient scriptures of Buddhism, what the texts show in the character of the Buddha is someone with a very advanced self-concept. His self-esteem is perfect. He has gone beyond doubt. He knows, and he is confident of his knowledge. He expresses himself with conviction. When the Buddha talks of himself in the first person, he does so with clarity. He has a strong sense of identity and knows very well who he is. He gives accounts of his life experiences in the first person. I think he's one of the first kind of earliest records we have from humankind of someone describing their spiritual experiences on record that we have. There's a few others, but there's very little else. So it's kind of a unique to someone, you know. So he gives accounts of his spiritual capacities in the first person. That is, or for example, he announces and proclaims that he is a Buddha, and he says what a Buddha is. He gives first-person accounts of the capacities required of him by society. For example, he insists he is a competent debater. He discusses at ease and in full equality with kings and other notables. He defends himself and his teachings against unjust accusations and false representations. It is clear that the Buddha's self, as this concept is understood in contemporary psychology and psychotherapy, namely a clear sense of identity, the ability to function competently and realistically in the world, to have a standard of ethics, to achieve one's goals, to interact with people, to make good choices, and so forth, was fully functional and remarkably well developed, as one would expect. Neither psychotherapy nor meditation is possible unless the sense of identity or ego is mature and well grounded. Otherwise, there's nothing to change and nothing to go beyond. So whatever those teachings of no self is, it's not meant to be a substitute to becoming someone who's confident, has a clear sense of themselves, has developed capacities and abilities. In fact, many of the qualities of strength that Buddhist practice is about developing, fit under the rubric, under the category of developing the Western psychotherapy, developing a strong sense of self. One of the reasons why Buddhists tend to be shy around using the language of self to talk about spiritual growth is because it's a heavy, it carries a lot of baggage with it, this concept of self. The people have a lot of personal, familial, and social, and psychotherapeutic associations, what it means to be a self and how you're supposed to be. And so if you take this kind of second level, meta level category, self, to describe something, it can get confusing very quickly. So what Buddhists tend to do is not to use that meta category, but rather focus more on the first level, the actual qualities that are being developed. Qualities of, many lists, but, faith and effort, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, generosity, ethics, patience, loving kindness, equanimity, compassion. There's a lot of different things that are developed as part of Buddhist practice. And some Buddhists will take time to focus on particular qualities so they become strong. Take a month or take a year to develop patience, to develop loving kindness, to develop ethical integrity, to develop generosity. A very important part of Buddhist practice is the cultivating side of it, to develop oneself. And if a person naively hears the teachings, or the teachings are given naively, that, kind of like, just let go. You're not supposed to have any desire. Just let go. Letting go is only half of the path. It's certainly a very important half of the path, but the other important half of the path is the side of cultivation. So in terms of having a purpose, there can be these interim purposes to develop particular qualities and particular strengths. And this, and developing these qualities and inner strengths are portable, that we can carry them with us. Not necessarily always, but this is a very important idea that there are enduring qualities that we can develop and strengthen and carry with us that become our support. Because otherwise the teachings about impermanence can just be depressing. So imagine someone who grew up in a very unstable family and their country's at war, they don't have a home, they don't have a job, and and they never had any solid footing in their life. Everything seems so unstable. And then they come to Buddhism and they say, yeah, that's right. it's everything's impermanent. That person would react to that teaching very differently than someone who had a stable upbringing, had an inner sense of inner stability, felt they knew themselves, it was stable in their hearts. Then, as Joy says here, then you can go beyond. So sometimes what we need to do is, it's very helpful to develop stability, some constancy. So the stability of concentration or calm, the stability and the capacity to be mindful, to show up, stability around our capacity to be generous or kind or friendly, stability in our ethics, some sense of stability, cultivate and develop it. Of course, it can't be guaranteed to be there all the time. Everything's impermanent, but it can be enduring for a while. And it's portable. So we cultivate these qualities inside of us, so the monastery that we live in is in our own hearts, the monastery within, rather than having to go off to the monastery. So we cultivate, and so we take, once you're outside of retreat, it can be very meaningful to choose different particular qualities that you're going to work on for a while and make these strengths. The Buddhist tradition talks about some of these qualities as in the language of strengths. Actually, not just strengths, but powers that we develop. So, and then with stability, with strength, with confidence, with a clear sense of understanding who we are, then it becomes much more meaningful and understandable what it means, the teaching of not self. It becomes much more doable and relevant to start letting go of all the ways in which we cling and get attached to a sense of self, because the confidence is there to see us through. Some people come up against the edge, like I did for a year of my practice, where I could see that my concepts of self were a form of clinging, and I knew that the next step for me was to let go of it. But seeing that step was kind of like looking like I had to step over a cliff into air, like there was nothing was going to support me, and it just was scary. I knew I'd have to let go of it. It just seemed like just ridiculous I was doing. It was painful that I was doing this. The games I was playing, all kinds of things. But I just, I was afraid. So I saw that I'm not ready yet. And so sometimes we want to need to develop greater confidence, greater trust, greater self-understanding, greater support. And then at some point, when the conditions are right, then it becomes easier to let go. In fact, when I finally let go, I kind of didn't know I was doing it when it happened. Isn't that remarkable? There I was, this thing I was really afraid of, and I thought it was going to be this big bang thing, like my world was going to disintegrate and it was going to be a disaster. I don't know what I thought, but just there was nothing there. It was this monumental thing, like, oh my God, this is going to be, and then sometimes I thought, this is going to be great, I can't wait. And then it happened, but I didn't notice. in retrospect, I noticed. I noticed that afterwards, like, oh, look at that. So you never know. You never know. I have a friend who has a tattoo on her ankle, and it's of a tortoise. And I never asked her, but my assumption has been that when she sits to meditate, cross-legged like this, the ankle's in the front. And if she looks down, she sees the tortoise. The tortoise wins the race. Slow and steady. So that was a pretty good tattoo. So the sense of purpose and the sense of stick to it, step by step. It's a beautiful path. It's a wonderful thing to do. It's meaningful for you. It's meaningful for others. It's meaningful for others that you do it. You don't have to be so good at it for it to be meaningful. And you don't have to be so good at it to inspire other people. Many years ago, I met a Zen teacher who, in some ways, I've known him for many years now. I don't think he's, I don't have to say this exactly, so Buddhistically mature, whatever that is, in terms of, you know, his. But I was so inspired by him, because by the time I met him, he had been practicing for 20 years. And what I felt from him was the sincerity of his intention. This was what he was devoted his life to, his intention. And even though he had an anger problem and had all kinds of issues, I was so inspired by this man. And I was fed by his by getting a sense of his sense of purpose and intention. This is what he was about. So I say this, is you don't have to be successful at this path to be inspiring to others. Just the fact that you found it and you do it, you engage, step by step, one step at a small step. As we come now to the end of the retreat and you get ready to go back to your world, to pick up yourself at the door, you might keep this in mind, that perhaps your mindfulness is not that strong. It'll come and go, and it won't be as strong as it would be here in the retreat. But I hope that one of the benefits of this kind of retreat is that it gives you confidence in the path, confidence in doing the practice. And the confidence is portable, more than states of mind. Your states of mind come and go, calm, agitated, whatever. But that confidence that this is a good path, this is a good practice to do. No amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. And so in all the different circumstances you find yourself after the retreat, some challenging, some not challenging, that no matter where you're at, you can call on your confidence to bring forth whatever mindfulness you have at that moment to meet it. And step by step, you'll find your way. Your practice, you always find your way if you're practicing mindfulness. The honesty of mindfulness will carry you through many circumstances. Okay? So let's sit, gather yourself together, check in. Check in with yourself, see where you're at, and breathe.